Do Not Disturb is a powerful investigation into a grisly political murder and the authoritarian regime behind it. It's a new book by Michaela Wrong. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from the UK, Michaela herself. Michaela, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Tell us a little bit about the narrative behind Rwanda, because obviously after the grisly genocide that dominated news coverage and appalled European nations in the 90s, we thought that Rwanda was now perhaps a bastion of an economic success story and a peaceful place. This, according to your reports, is completely a false narrative.
Well, credit where it's due. It's certainly seen some impressive economic growth rates. It's been very efficient, for example, at holding COVID in check. It scores well on a lot of developmental indicators. But what my book tells is the story on the human rights front, which is looking at things like the fact that anyone who criticizes the government ends up fleeing the country, the hounding of exiles and human rights activists and journalists who flee abroad by the regime, the way in which people who do stand up to the regime either disappear or are jailed or simply killed inside Rwanda itself, and then the killings, the assassinations on outside of Rwanda, as far afield as places like South Africa, of prominent dissidents, people who used to belong to the regime and have gone into opposition and been critical of it. And there are an awful lot of cases of this. They've been very well documented, and I was a bit surprised that nobody else had written a book about them. So that's one of the key themes in my book.
So tell me a little bit about what happened, because many of us remember the dreadful scenes coming out of Rwanda, and many of people, I suppose, that was immortalized in the film Hotel Rwanda, if you like. What was the aftermath then? Because there were invasions. Was it Paul Kagame, who is still president of Rwanda?
And Kagame started off as vice president, but right. He was always the man in control, and that was always known to everybody, journalists, diplomats, aid workers, everyone in the country knew it, and eventually he took the presidency. And I think the fear now is that he's going to be a president for life, because the constitution, which should have limited him to two terms, has been altered, as it has in many African states, and so he's going to be allowed to run and run. And I think what you saw is, in the 90s you saw a lot of adventures in which the Rwandan Patriotic Front and the Rwandan army was sort of intervening in its neighboring countries, toppling first Mobutu Sese Seko in Zaire, and then sort of also intervened to try and get rid of his successor, Laurent Kabila. So I think Rwanda proved to be a bit of a bully in the neighborhood, in the Great Lakes region. What you've really seen is this tightening control inside Rwanda itself, which has increasingly tense relationships with many of its neighboring countries, particularly Uganda now. This sort of, every election is almost certainly being rigged. You can tell that from the ridiculous figures that President Kagame and his ruling party get at every election. There's no such thing as a free press. Everyone sort of every media outlet sycophantically choruses what Kagame and the RPF want to be heard. And also very, very tight control on the economy. So although it's supposed to be a great place for foreign investment, in fact, the ruling party controls all the sort of really juicy bits of the economy and is busy basically smuggling minerals from eastern Congo into Rwanda and then selling them to the rest of the world as though they were Rwandan produce.
As it so often is, I mean, we look at that area of Africa and we think of nations, but is it perhaps more a question of tribes? I mean, we remember the Tutsi and the Hutu, who were the predominant, and it was, and forgive me if my history is incorrect, it was predominantly a Hutu against Tutsi situation in the genocide.
Well, the genocide was a horrific incident, horrific episode in which, up to between 500,000 and 1,000,000, mostly Tutsis were killed by Hutu extremists and by the army of Juvenal Habyarimana, who was the Hutu president. Nowadays in Rwanda, nobody talks about ethnicity. You don't, you know, it's considered to be not the dumb thing. You know, you do not ask a modern Rwandan whether they're Hutu or Tutsi. They are all Rwandans. And I think that's only something, that's something we can only welcome. That's a very healthy development. But there's also an extent to which, you know, people are being forced to behave and pretend that these issues have gone away. And in fact, I think every Rwandan is very aware of which ethnic community they belong to. And, you know, there are definitely claims by people in the Hutu opposition that the Tutsis have sort of got all the juicy, important power-wielding positions in government. So just because you want something to go away, just because you want to remove that toxic relationship, doesn't mean it just vanishes overnight.
And I mean, I remember the narrative at the time seemed to be that the Tutsis were sort of this, and it goes back to the colonial thing, doesn't it? The Tutsis were sort of long-limbed and pastoral and sort of almost light-skinned, whilst the Hutu were much more squat, sort of almost. I mean, that was what we were being told at the time. I mean, wasn't that was kind of the narrative.
That's the narrative. What you'll hear people say in Rwanda today is that a lot of this was sort of, while it existed in pre-colonial times, these differences in terms of status, in terms of roles in society, you know, certainly the aristocracy were Tutsi and the laboring serfs tended to be Hutus, that it was a more malleable and more flexible relationship. And then it became cemented during German rule and then Belgian rule, so that these positions, these sort of ethnic definitions then became sort of fixed, and you would have an ID card in which you were identified as one or the other. But, you know, what you hear historians say is that previous to that, it was more of a socioeconomic difference. You know, if you owned a large herd of a cattle, you would be defined as Tutsi. If you lost your cattle because you fell on hard times, you could end up being redefined as a Hutu. You know, you'd be working the fields, and you would sort of then be redefined. So I think, like many of the things that we saw in during colonial rule of Africa, certain differences were exacerbated and exaggerated, and then became very toxic.
Tell me a little bit about Patrick Karegeya then, who was the Rwandan spy chief.
Patrick, yes, he was the head of external intelligence. He was also a sort of slightly Alistair Campbell-like figure. He used to be the person who would come out and greet journalists who went to Rwanda, maybe looking for a presidential interview. He was very affable. He was laid back with the press. He was laid back with everyone. He had friends everywhere. He was incredibly well-connected. He sort of knew every intelligence chief in Africa. Most of the foreign ministers and many of the presidents were on first-name terms. He was also somebody who had been to school with Kagame, Paul Kagame. They had known each other from the bush, not just in Rwanda, but in Uganda, where both of them had joined President Yoweri Museveni's then rebel movement. So they had been in the bush together fighting as rebels in Uganda. They had then set up this secret movement, the Rwandan Patriotic Front, which nestled in the heart of the Ugandan army. And then it was really at Patrick's house that the invasion in 1990 of the Rwandan Patriotic Force, the invasion of Rwanda, was planned and plotted. So he was always a very important part of the RPF and a very, very close friend of Kagame, which I think was why it was so shocking when he was found strangled in South Africa's Michelangelo Hotel, very obviously on the orders of his former boss and his former friends, because you thought, well, how on earth did it get to this point? He had become increasingly critical of Kagame, increasingly unhappy with the authoritarian drift that Kagame's rule was taking, increasingly unhappy about restrictions on press freedom, on the quiet elimination that was taking place of critics of the government. And he ended up setting up an opposition party in exile, which began attracting other key dissidents. And I think that was when, you know, the president decided, okay, he's a threat and I need to get rid of him.
So why did you decide to write Do Not Disturb? Is it because we sort of turn a blind eye to Rwanda and we think, well, they're you know, becoming a model of success, and because of what happened there? I mean, they're still receiving you know, large amounts of Western aid, aren't they?
Yes, it's very heavily dependent on Western aid. I think I calculated that it was 62% of the government's budget comes from Western aid. I decided to write the book because what I was hearing about the kind of repression, the kind of attacks on Rwandan exiles, and the kind of repression that was taking place of ordinary Rwandans back home just seemed so much at odds with this glowing, this golden image that Rwanda seemed to enjoy, you know, in the international conference sector, as you know, that you were seeing Paul Kagame appearing in Davos and being sort of treated like a kind of savior, a hero, a saint, and being asked to lecture at American universities. And you were thinking, you know, this is actually an increasingly repressive regime, and it doesn't seem to me that these, despite the fact that these stories were being reported in the press, nobody was putting it all together and saying this is a very worryingly repressive authoritarian government, and why exactly are we encouraging its authoritarian streak by constantly feeding it with more Western aid?
So how willing were people to talk to you about this, if it is a repressive regime? I mean, and he is ruthless, Kagame. How easy was it to get people to talk to you about what's going on?
Well, it was very difficult because so many people would tell you things, and then at the end of the interview, they'd say, you can only use this if you don't identify me in any way. And so, you know, no writer likes to end up with anonymous sources. But often it was inevitable because that had been the understanding. They would only talk to you if you wouldn't identify them. What of course you do find is that people who are in exile and who have been targeted by the regime and know they will never be able to go back home, and who have been threatened sometimes with death, who've been warned by local police forces they're in danger, they'll talk to you because they've burnt all their bridges. And so, you know, some people have sort of said of my book, well, it's a sort of case for the prosecution. And you sort of think, well, yeah, because, you know, nobody else would talk to me. So essentially, I've given those people whose perspectives and accounts had been long ignored, I've given them a chance to put their case and make their very valid criticisms of the regime.
You've covered Africa for a number of years now, and the situation over in that particular region, the Great Lakes. Is it? I mean, when you discover what lies beneath the official narrative, and yet again there seems to be an even, you know, another African basically despot dictator at work. Do you sigh? Do you think, you know, are there going to be examples of African nations in that area actually functioning unlike dictatorships?
I try not to sort of generalize too much about Africa because it's such an enormous continent, and you know, I've sort of written books about Eritrea, about Kenya, about Congo, about Rwanda, and each story is so completely different. I think, you know, the story of Rwanda's story is worrying because I see it as a destabilizing influence on a very large and fragile region. I also think it's worrying because I think too often the West is encouraging certain trends while thinking that it's sending out all the right messages. It's actually sending out really unhelpful messages. But I try not to sort of look too big picture, because for every sort of depressing story, there is a more optimistic story. I'm just focusing on certain countries and telling those stories, the ones that I know best.
What do you hope that people take then from Do Not Disturb? A greater understanding of what's going on in Rwanda and the neighbouring nations?
I think it's a story that applies not only to Rwanda, it also applies to a lot of other countries that have been through a liberation struggle, you know, and had a liberation movement seize control. I mean, we've seen it we've seen it in Europe, we've seen it in Asia. There comes a point where after a war, the people who took you through the war need to step down. And instead, in so many cases, what you see is the liberation movement, the rebel movement, gets stuck into running the country, decides it rather likes doing that, takes control of the economy, all sorts of corrupt deals start being done, and suddenly, you know, it loses its appetite for debate, it loses its appetite for a free press, it loses its appetite for genuine elections. And this is not an African story, this is a global story. So I think this book isn't just about Rwanda, it's about how, you know, the revolution ends up eating its own. It's just one example of that story.
The book is called Do Not Disturb, the story of a political murder and an African regime gone bad. It's out now on, is it Public Affairs Books it's available on?
It's Public Affairs in the US, but here in Europe, it's HarperCollins, Fourth Estate imprint.
And it's by Michaela Long. If people want to find you on social media, do you tweet?
I am on Twitter. I sort of tend to just put things out there because it's a very controversial book, this one, so there's an awful lot of, heated debate going on, and I can't sort of get involved in all of that, or I'd spend my entire day answering tweets, but I do read them with great interest.
Only begs the question, I mean, after this one, what are you turning your attentions to work-wise? I know that, you know, obviously you've got huge experience in that particular field. Are you planning another book? Are you focusing on journalism? What's your next move, as it were?
I'm actually thinking of doing a family memoir. It's a complete break. People always say, why do you write about Africa? Why don't you write about your own country? Well, I might just write about my own family instead.
Well, hopefully there's considerably less intrigue and daring do and dark deeds with your family, but there you go. Michaela Rong, author of Do Not Disturb, the story of political murder and an African regime gone bad. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you very much.